From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. And we are thrilled to welcome in Teresa Yeomans, who is going to join us by phone. Teresa, good day to you.
Good day to you, too.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Wish it was in person, but we're back to our whatever it is, protocols. We don't know if it's post-COVID, pre-COVID, or what it is. But thank you for taking the time to be with us. You started a ministry called Grief Share at Holy Spirit there in Fairfield. Tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved in it.
I got involved in it when my husband died, which was 6 years ago. I got involved in the program through a Baptist church because I needed some kind of guidance and counseling after the loss of my husband. And then about 2 years later, I was sharing the benefits of the Grief Share program with another parishioner who said they'd love something like that at our parish. So I went to Father Joel, and I had a really good sales pitch, figuring I'd sell it to him and let someone else take the reins. And he said, well, if you want it here, you do it. And I've been running the Grief Share program for the last 4 years.
Wow. So Grief Share is a non-denominational program?
Yes, it is.
And it's based in North Carolina?
Yes, it is.
Is it religious-based?
It's Christian-based.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There's a lot of reference to the Bible. There's a lot of reference to prayer. There's a lot of references to calling on God in times, not so much to answer your questions, but to give you strength and to give you guidance through the healing process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how long has it been around, you know?
No, I really don't know, but it's not been around that long. When I started in 2016, in this area alone, there were only three churches that were running this program. And the last time I looked, I believe there's 12 right now in
Wow.
the Fairfield-Sassoon area. And it's slowly growing.
And you say churches, you're talking about other than Catholic churches?
Other than Catholic churches, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I know when my oldest sister's husband died a few years ago, and she was at St. Mary's in Vacaville at the time, and they had a bereavement ministry, not Grief Share, but they had a bereavement ministry of some kind that she wasn't even aware of, and she said it was just so helpful to her.
Yeah, what the beauty of this program is that it gives you a sense of normalcy
mm-hmm.
in a time when everything is abnormal. It gives you guidance on how to establish what we call your new norm. It gives you tools to help you navigate. It lets you know what you're feeling is okay. But it also gives you tools on how to handle the emotions that you're often feeling.
Mm-hmm. So the... what is it about Grief Share that struck you? Was it something you just tripped on, or were people giving you advice as to what you should do?
Honestly, what I did was I got on the internet and I typed in grief.
Mm-hmm.
And Grief Share popped up, and I looked at it, and there was a contact, and I reached out to Greg, who at the time was the facilitator at the church that I went through, and he just listened. More than anything else, he just listened and let me know that my pain was mine, but not completely unique, that other people are feeling what I'm feeling. And he invited me to come to the group and just go through the program with him and his co-facilitator. And they were just beyond phenomenal. And it didn't matter that I was Catholic and they were Baptist. They mm-hmm. made me feel very welcome.
You note in the Catholic Herald story about this that the beauty of the ministry is that it's done with love. Explain that just a little bit.
Well, we do it with love to let them know that they're not alone. We listen to them. And I think that's one of the key things is you need someone to hear your grief and to know that that they understand your struggle. We do it. We don't put people down. We encourage, positive behavior. If there's mistakes that were made along the way and we're human, we make them. We let people know that that's okay, that these mistakes are made. Yeah, some of them have to be rectified, and we give them tools as to how to mend fences. We mm-hmm. give them mm-hmm. options. So I think it's a lot of just patience and kindness, the things that everybody needs and wants in life. So in a way, it's a loving act.
I remember the first time I had to accompany my parents to a home where someone had died, and I was probably about 12 years old, and I couldn't imagine what was going to what I could say or what I didn't want to go. It was like I think a lot of people have that feeling even as adults, like they don't know what to say, they don't know how to help, and yet people need help. People need you.
What the biggest thing to do, I think, is listen.
Mm-hmm.
The grieving person needs to be heard. They need to know that what they're feeling is okay. I mean, they've lost someone, whether it be spouse or child or parent. They've lost somebody that's a key element in their life. And they need someone to understand and hear that grief. I know that after I lost Fred, a lot of people, there were some, they honestly thought they were helping, and they were making statements like, well, he's in a better place, mm-hmm. or he completed his journey. And all that did was anger me and hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized through grief share that they didn't know how to approach me any better than I knew how to approach them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really can be helpful to a grieving person is to make a list of the things that they need. And they can be from anywhere from just sitting to talking with me. Maybe they need their lawn mowed or somebody to help them run the vacuum cleaner or something. And when somebody comes up and says, what can I do to help you? You can say, well, these are some of the things I need.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do any of this, it would be appreciated. Because the grieving person needs to be able to direct the people that are coming to help. And if the people that are coming to help have a little bit of direction, then I think both sides can benefit from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of the common stereotype is the casserole on the doorstep, and we don't know if that's helpful or it's not helpful.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember when my dad passed away and had a long struggle with Parkinson's, where he just kind of gradually went downhill and finally passed away from complications from Parkinson's. His colon twisted and the rest was pretty quick from being bedridden. And my mom, who was an RN, had retired to take care of him and was really with him just day and night. As much as the rest of us tried to help, it was my mom saw it as she's doing it out of love, not out of duty. And yet I remember after he died, and people are coming by, and I remember one of my coaches from college came by and knocked on the door and had known my folks, and and I greeted him at the door, and he said, "How's your mom doing?" I said, "Oh, she's hanging in there, you know." And he said, "Well, it's probably better off, you know." And I looked at him and I said, "Don't say that to my mom, because she doesn't think she's better off."
Well, I have a similar story. I was walking my dogs one day and thinking about him, and I looked up to the heavens and I said to my husband, "Oh, I'm glad you're dead." And then I started sobbing and I went to grief share, and Greg said, "It isn't that I was glad he was dead. I was greatly relieved he's no longer suffering."
Right, right.
He didn't say it right.
Yeah.
But that was the intention. And yep. He said that there's nothing wrong with that at all. It's not. But a lot of the people have this guilt trip after watching a loved one suffer for so long, and then they feel horrible because
right. They're
thinking those thoughts. And there's nothing wrong with those thoughts.
No, and I know, I presume that was what my friend meant, you know, but I cautioned him that probably wouldn't be, wouldn't make my mom feel any better.
And right at that time, it would have been a cold slap in her face.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so many of us, even when it seems inevitable with someone that's had a long-term disease, we still feel that we somehow didn't do enough, or we didn't, you know, maybe we should have gone to one more doctor or one more appointment or tried one more therapy or something, you know. And the church is very clear that we don't have to do crazy things to extend life.
No.
You know, we certainly don't believe in assisted suicide or assisted death or whatever you want to call it. But we don't have to just prolong life to prolong life, that we're all going to die.
We need to allow that person to pass into the next
world
with dignity as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that with grief share, when they talk about emotions, they want us to acknowledge our emotions. They want us to deal with our emotions appropriately. They don't want you to wear your emotions on your sleeve, or when somebody comes in and makes even an inappropriate statement, that you're snarling at them and that you turn to this, you know, raving lunatic.
Right.
And grief share guides you through recognizing the emotions and dealing with the emotions appropriately. One of the things that we repeat several times is an acronym in the group. In the program, it's called DEER, D-E-E-R, and it stands for drink, eat, exercise, and rest.
Hmm.
In other words, drink plenty of fluids or what you can medically have. I learned that there was a gal that had a limit, but they're talking about water. Water is the great thing
right.
for the body. To eat regular small meals, to exercise, nothing extraordinary, but even if you just get out and walk around the block, and rest. And what they mean by rest, not necessarily sleep, but if you become tired during the day, during this grieving process, allow yourself to rest. Put on some soft music and allow your mind to just float, or pick up your Bible. This is your quiet time mm-hmm. to read the Bible. So do something that is restful.
So was there one thing in particular about grief share that just really resonated?
I think more than anything else, it put my feet on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything else, because it helped me understand what I was feeling was normal. It also too helped me understand that this is not an over-the-night process. You know, you don't wake up one morning, snap your fingers, and I'm all better.
Right.
But this could take, for some people, it could take 5, especially on the loss of a spouse, on the loss of a child, it could take 10 years
mm-hmm.
before you finally reach that, your new set of normal. And if it takes you that long, then it takes you that long, and that's okay.
Yeah, I think one of the problems is for people are that are around you. I mean, not necessarily family members, but people, acquaintances. It's sort of like they kind of want to put a time limit on it. They kind of want to, okay, this happened to you, but it's been a month. It's been 2 months. You know, like get over it. You know, and that has to be very hard for a person.
Yes, it really is. And when you have someone say that, you feel so isolated and so alone.
Yep.
You know, unless you had some real counseling, and then there was a gentleman in our group that their doctor said that to them, and he looked at him and went, really? You know, and he just shook his head, and he said, I fell back onto grief share.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I guess, and the other thing is, you know, depending on the, you know, your circumstances at the time too, you may lose a spouse unexpectedly, and you've got 4 children under the age of 10 in the home who are expecting you to be there tomorrow and the next day and tonight, and you know, and still chase the monsters away from under the bed, and you don't feel like doing anything like that. Or, you know, an employer that gives you, well, take the next week off. We'll see you a week from Monday. And you're like, oh, I don't feel like I could go back to work for 5 years. You know,
what a lot of people don't realize, and Grief Share does point this out, is that, yes, you have the initial loss of whoever your loved one was.
Right.
But then you can have many, many, what they call mini losses. If your spouse was the main breadwinner, or if the income was, say, equal, all of a sudden you've lost the income, you've lost the confidant. If you're a parent, you've lost the responsibility of tending that child. Now you've got this huge chunk of boy time. What do I do with it?
Yeah, and you have to deal with the grief your children are experiencing.
Yeah. Or other family members.
Or other family members, yeah. Yes. Siblings and maybe even parents of your spouse.
Yes. And you also have their belongings to deal with. That can be the hardest thing yet, to go into the room that they were in and have to pack their clothing and their belongings up, because you're packing a life away, and that can be traumatic and very painful.
Sure. There's so much to it, and it's the founder of Grief Share. Had he experienced something like this?
Yes, the founder of Grief Share. They're a couple. They lost 2 children.
Oh wow!
At infancy, and they didn't have any support, and I don't know when they founded Grief Share. But they began to realize that other people were experiencing grief and floundering, and this is why they established the program. They have won some mini courses too. One of the ones that I teach in the 15 weeks, it's actually a 13-week course, the 13 classes, but I insert one that they offer called Surviving the Holidays. And then I do a closing class. So those are the 2 that I've added on. But they also are offering now something called divorce care. And they also offer a class specifically for the loss of a spouse. So, and they offer workshops back there, too. So there's a lot more to the program.
Yeah, divorce is a whole other issue, isn't it, in terms of grief and...
there are a lot of other issues, but there are a lot of similarities.
Very similar, too. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because you're not dealing with the death of a loved one, but you're dealing with the death of a relationship.
Right.
I've never been divorced, but yeah, so there are some similarities. But yeah, they have their own unique problems, and I'm sure I haven't explored divorce care, but I'm sure that they address those more specific problems where we deal with the death of someone. So.
And, you know, I mean, people should know that the Catholic Church, I mean, you know, we don't obviously approve of divorce, and yet they should know that anyone who is divorced is welcome in our church, you know, and
yeah.
And we will do everything we can to help them.
Yeah. So the program, and I encourage churches to really look into it, you need, first, the approval of your church, your pastor.
Right.
You need a little bit of technical because there's a video that goes with it. So you need some way to, they come on CDs. And they are also online, so mm-hmm. if you can plug a bigger screen into that. And what it is, the way I run the class is we do a review of the previous week, and we allow discussion. I read over, there's an outline in the book. We watch the video, and then we discuss the outline. So mm-hmm. what I'm saying, it's very, very structured. So it's easy. It is and it isn't easy because you're dealing with people's emotions.
Sure.
So that can be harder. But as far as having a core curriculum, you've got a solid one, and they walk you through step by step.
And you meet weekly?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You meet weekly for, if you're just doing the class, it's 13 weeks. Like I said, I insert one additional class and a closing class.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, anything I didn't ask you that you'd like to point out?
No. Other than that, I'm hoping this opens the door for other churches, and I'm hoping that they'll look into the program.
Very good. Well, Teresa, it's a joy to talk with you. Thanks for all you do. I'm sure you're really helping a tremendous number of people, and I share your prayer and your hope that more parishes will look into this program.
Okay.
Hey, thanks so much. God bless you.
God bless you, too.
Thanks so much. That's wow. That's very tough stuff. But Teresa Yeomans, just really, really, that's really inspiring. You can read more about that in the current issue of the Catholic Herald about her experience with grief share, and also a woman named Roxanne Bradley and her experience with grief share as well. We'll take a quick break. Back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
This is Bishop William K. Wiegand, the Bishop Emeritus of Sacramento, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dennis.
Welcome back, everyone. A lot happening here in the diocese as we move on through the summer. The Quo Vadis retreat for boys ages 13 to 17 will be August 5th through the 7th. Boys ages 13 to 17 will learn about the priesthood, the diaconate, and married life. The retreat will be in person at Trinity Pines Catholic Center, 28,000 Rollins Lake Road up in Colfax. Also, the Gabriel Project annual gathering Saturday, August 6th from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at St. Philomene's Parish, which is at 2428 Bell right here in Sacramento. The Gabriel Project's annual gathering is an opportunity for parish teams to get to know others who are passionate about supporting pregnant mothers and their unborn children. This gathering will allow parish teams to connect with local resources and organizations to better minister to moms in need. Registration starts at 8:30 a.m., and the program will start promptly at 9 again at St. Philomene's on Bell, Saturday, August 6th, 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. And then Walking with Mary Retreat by Sacramento Council, Diocesan Council of Catholic Women, Saturday, August 27th. 8:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. You're invited to join as they transform their annual convention and take time to walk with Mary in prayer. This very special women's event will include champagne lunch, inspiring mother-daughter speakers, Pam Hurwitz and Jillian Rhodes, who are the founders of the Faith and Family Collective. This event aims to provide women of all ages an opportunity to pause, reflect, recharge, connect with other women, and grow in their faith and relationship with God. We can all benefit from slowing down and learning how to walk with Mary in faith. It will all take place at the St. Mel Parish Center, 4748 Pennsylvania Avenue in Fair Oaks. Also, the Respect Life Gathering, the annual gathering, Saturday, August 27, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The Respect Life Gathering is an opportunity to come together to talk about current pro-life issues, learn about advocacy, share best practices, and network with others in the ministry. Open to all parish volunteers, teachers, youth, and young adults, and anyone who has a passion for the pro-life cause. Holy Family Parish, 7817 Old Auburn Road in Citrus Heights, again Saturday, August 27. Also, the On Fire. Circle that date, Saturday, September 17, 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. at Six Flags, Discovery Kingdom in Vallejo, featuring Epic the Band, Marie Pablo, Joe Melendrez, Steve Agresano, and Father Joe Kim. Go to On Fire NorCal, that's N-O-R-C-A-L, onfirenorcal.com. Well, we had a wonderful opportunity to sit down and talk with Dr. Corey Novak about prison ministry and specifically about compassion in dying in the prisons. And we're going to bring you that interview and that discussion now. Pleased and honored to welcome in Dr. Corey Novak, a specialist in a lot of things. Corey, good day to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
You are calling in from, or we're calling you from Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
How's Pikes Peak looking today?
It's gorgeous. It's a clear day, 70 degrees, just perfect.
You're kidding. And have you been to the top?
I have. I grew up in this area, so many school trips to the top of Pikes Peak.
My wife and I were visiting Colorado Springs just for one day, visiting relatives. It was like a reunion kind of thing, and I learned there was a road to the top, you know, and I couldn't get anybody to go, so it's still on my bucket list.
Well, come out and visit, and we'll go.
Okay. All right. You got a deal. That's great. Corey, we could spend the rest of the day reading your resume. You have such a varied background. What would you describe? What would you describe both your occupation and your avocation as?
Well, I would say that I'm first and foremost an advocate, mm-hmm. For compassion. And then my job is working, I consult primarily in healthcare and end-of-life care for underserved populations. So not only do I work with prison populations, but also Native American tribes and other kind of populations that people don't always think about when you think about underserved.
Mm-hmm. So I noticed that... you did a postdoc on end-of-life care and aging at Stanford, with the School of Medicine there. Now your doctorate is a PhD, a doctor of philosophy. You're not an MD.
Correct.
And you're in what field is the PhD?
Human services and gerontology.
Very good. Very good. So let's talk, if you would, about aging and end-of-life in the Department of Corrections.
Absolutely. You know, not a lot of people love talking about death. You know, it's one of those things that people invite me to parties and I start talking about what I do, and suddenly people walk away from me.
They show you the door?
Yeah, it's like, ooh, who's a girl talking about death and being in prison and getting old? And, you know, it's not exactly a party hot spot when I'm around. But, you know, I just have really found that, you know, not only do people not like to talk about things like death because it's frightening for many people,
sure.
But then you start talking about people who are marginalized and often forgotten, and that's the folks in the prison system. And I think we as a culture tend to forget that, you know, these people are going to grow old and die there. And mm-hmm. not everybody gets shanked. Not everybody is like on the TV, you know, where they're all buff and scary and...
Right.
They're going to get old. They're going to have disease like we have on the outside. And they're going to die, natural deaths in prison. And nobody cares. And it's really, I shouldn't say nobody, very few people care. And it's one of those things where, you know, oftentimes when I speak to groups or I'm out talking about this, people will say, well, but it's prisoners. You know, they get what they deserve.
Right,
or
right.
Who cares, you know. And what I tell people is there's two ways to look at it. And you can look at it the way I got into it, which is kind of the human and compassion side, and say, you know what? I am not the same person I was when I was 20, and I made lots of mistakes when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to say I'm a better person. And you know what? We all do that. I think most people would say they're not the same person, and they made some mistakes along the way. And, you know, we don't show enough grace, both to ourselves and to others. So there's that compassionate component, but for those people who just look at me and say, Corey, they get what they deserve. You know, where was their compassion when they murdered somebody? Where
right,
was their compassion?
Right.
You know, and I get that. I absolutely do. But I don't feel like I was called to judge people like that. And so that's why I do what I do. But those people who don't care, the next thing I say, well, do you like money? And most people look at me and go, yeah, I like money. Well, let me tell you the research I've done through my PhD, and let me tell you how much these people who you hate, you just said you don't care about,
yeah.
how much they're going to cost you as they get old. And that's why when I talk about compassionate care in prison, whether you care because you are compassionate or you care because you love money, you need to hear what I have to say, because in the end, it hits both of those sectors, and it works.
Yeah. Go teach me.
Well, you know, it's really interesting when I talk to people, because you do, and some of the nicest people are the ones that will say, I don't care about prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
They did wrong. That's what they deserve. And you know what? I don't judge those people either, because I don't know what they've been through, and maybe they've got some baggage that, you know, is sure. informing their decisions. But I do feel like this is a group, and I've gone into the prisons. Like I said, I did my PhD there. I had to go into prisons, do the research. I met people, and not everybody is a murderer. Not everybody is a violent criminal. And for many of them, they are different people. There are bad people in prison, make no mistake. There are people who certainly deserve to be there. But I don't believe that whether you deserve to be there or not, that anybody deserves to die alone.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens in prisons, at least those without hospices, and most prisons in the United States do not have a hospice. I will say in California, you're very lucky. Because there is, in fact, that's where the first prison hospice started, was in California at the men's penal colony. But when you don't have a hospice and prisoners are not given a choice, and this is kind of where the money piece comes in, we are, by regulation, we must care for these prisoners. We must give them health care.
Right.
We don't get to say, oh, you have ESRD, well, you can choose to die or not. We have to take care of you, no matter what. And people can live for a very long time, even getting the bare minimum health care.
Sure.
And so then we are paying for these people that some people don't care about for every trip to the emergency room,
mm-hmm.
all the extra guards that it takes for them to go to the emergency
sure.
room or to go to dialysis, which can be $7,000 to $14,000 per treatment.
Wow.
And people that go to dialysis go 3 to 4 times a week right. for the rest of their lives.
Right.
Right? So we're looking at, and let's face it, most folks that are in our prisons did not participate in their wellness program before they got to prison.
Yeah, that's invariably true, yeah.
So, you know, they tend to be a little bit sicker. And your body, when you are in the prison, when you're incarcerated, your body ages 10 to 15 years faster than for non-incarcerated people.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is, you know, what I consider young, 40, 50, 60-year-old people having diseases of 70, 80, 90-year-old people.
Mm-hmm.
And 70, 80, 90-year-old people not being able to function because their bodies are 80, 90, 100-year-old people. And yet we have to keep them alive, right? So by giving people an option, we are not only saving taxpayer money, but we are providing some dignity and some choice in their life, which for some they may never have had much in their lives. And then the amazing part about what I've done is all the other things that happen. So I can talk all day about the money we're going to save, how compassionate it is. But then there's the pieces that I can tell you about, but my words don't do them justice, and that's the experience. It's watching inmates who are spending their life in prison. They did something bad to be there for life. Change when you teach them how to care for each other.
Hmm.
And I'll give away this story because it's one of the most powerful stories I've ever experienced. But I did a couple TED Talks, and I tell this story in the TED Talk. And I'm not sure if anybody actually didn't cry. And it almost made me cry because I was looking at the audience, and they were all crying.
Right.
But I had this beautiful experience of this man who was in prison for hate crimes. He was Caucasian. On his knuckles, he had the words white power
mm-hmm.
tattooed. I mean, just... If you could paint a white supremacist, this was this man. He was the quintessential white supremacist. And he was also a hospice volunteer. And one of the hospice patients was dying at the end of life, meaning a few hours or less. And I watched this white man go up to the black man. And we are in the South. We are in Angola prison in Louisiana. We are mm-hmm. in the deep South. And I watched those white power hands pick up a cool cloth and wipe it on his face and hold this black man's hand
And very softly, he bent down to him and he said, "My friend, go home in love." And I was beyond myself to hear "go home in love" and watch him tenderly touch this dying man's head was beyond powerful. And for those people who think that everyone that's there deserves to be there, you know, maybe they're right, because sometimes we learn the hardest lessons in the hardest places. But in the end, the right thing happens. And I watched it. I've seen it so many times, so many lessons, so many things that I thought I would experience when I was, you know, visiting the prisons, going to prison. It's so funny, I just, as a side note, whenever I say I'm going to prison, you should see the looks that I get. And people, my mom, when my mom was alive, would say, "Where's Corey today?" And she'd say, "She's in prison." But the things that I've learned going to prison are things that, you know, I grew up reading the Bible, being taught those beliefs and those ethics. And you hear them, but until you experience it, until you've gone behind the bars, until you've seen compassion in action, it's all just academic.
Yeah, I remember years ago, I've been a sports writer off and on most of my life, and I got asked to referee the annual football game between two cell blocks, I guess, for want of a better word, at the state prison in Vacaville, California, and had no idea what I was getting in for. I mean, none. And they had me come down the day before so I could go to practice and introduce myself and all that. And they gave me all the appropriate warnings, you know, and the guard towers are all around. And they said, you know, the last 3 years, this football game has not finished. it got into fights, and that was, you know, nothing real serious, but they called it off before it got more heated. But being able to talk to these guys and see, even in their situation, not all of them were lifers, but a lot of them were, and to see how important this football game was to them, and to talk to some of them and hear their life stories. Some were very contrite and admitted, and others felt like, you know, they'd been railroaded, and I didn't know the truth of their situations. But it was so many of them, it started out with drugs as teenagers.
Yeah.
And they got into petty street crime, and then somebody ended up getting in a fight, and somebody died, or somebody got badly hurt, and suddenly it's a completely different ballgame. They were part of the system at that point and just could never get out of that cycle. They could get out of prison and couldn't get a job, and they'd fall back into the bad ways, and then now they got two strikes, now they got three strikes, and we're going to throw away the key. And it was very revealing to somebody from the outside who was used to covering football games in stadiums with guys that were in college, you know. But the football game still mattered to them. You know, it was something for them to hold on to. And I left that experience. I was partly glad to leave that experience alive, but I left that experience with a completely different view. You see the number of people that are in prison and the percent of the population and all the demographics of it, and it sometimes becomes just a bunch of numbers. And I was never one of those, you know, they're getting what they deserve and throw away the key. But by the same token, I didn't have a face to them, and now I had a face, and realized that they had a heart and they had a soul, and they had at one point had a family, and probably when they were 8 years old dreamed about playing in the major leagues like I dreamed about playing in the major leagues, you know. And then that dream went away somehow. And It just gave me a and when I heard we were going to talk, I thought this is, you know, this is something that I'd really like to explore. I know that the Catholic Church, of course, has a tremendous prison ministry, a lot of deacons and priests and stuff. It's very big. I know our Bishop Soto here is very big on prison ministry as well, personally, and. It's so important, but I didn't know about hospice in prison. Are you saying that not only, like in California, we have hospice by law, but a lot of the prisoners actually participate as hospice volunteers?
Yes. Typically, in a prison-run hospice, the volunteers, the people who do death watches, who sit with the dying, the people who read to them, the people who assist in just changing their, you know, their bed clothes and mm-hmm. changing their beds, they are all inmates.
Wow.
Because to bring somebody in would be quite a big deal.
Right.
You know, anybody that goes in, like for prison ministries, you have to get, you know, you have all kinds of hoops you need to jump through.
Exactly.
So just to bring a kind-hearted person in, no matter how kind-hearted they are, is quite a task.
Right.
To get them into a prison. So when prison hospices first began, it was like, well, who do we have here? Well, you know, if we vet them properly and teach them how to be volunteers, they're the perfect volunteer because they're there 24/7. They can create this family feeling because they're there all the time.
Sure.
And it does wonders for them. One of the things that I do when I do consult is I teach inmates how to care for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been moments that have just blown my mind when I'm teaching 40, 50-year-old men the difference between good touch and bad touch.
Hmm.
And I think, okay, are you telling me you didn't learn this when you were 3 or 5? And, you know, I grew up in such a functional, wonderful family that I can't fathom not having that. I know it's out there. And obviously I've seen so many unfortunate examples of it. But it's true. We take for granted, for those of us who have had good upbringings, that, you know, there's so many out there that don't. And thank goodness there's so many out there that may not, but don't end up in prison. But for a majority of the folks who end up in prison, one of the things they will tell you is they had a rough home life.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's many that say, no, my mom loves me. And, you know, and you see it on TV, you know, families going. But those are not the norm. And what we see or what we think we know about prisons, good or bad, is not necessarily the norm. And it's really amazing the amount of humanity and care that occurs in a prison when other people, when the inmates know you are there to help them. It was so funny when I was in Angola. I was getting ready to leave for the day, and you know, I'm really literally in the middle of the prison compound, behind, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles of rows of razor wire and walls. And one of the inmates said to me, one of the hospice volunteers said, "Well, ma'am, where are you going to go eat tonight?" And so I told him, I looked up this place, I'm going to go there, and he said, "Oh, Miss Corey, that's a really dangerous place.
Wow,
I wouldn't go there." I'm standing in the middle of Angola State Prison, and you're telling me I'm going to a dangerous place? But heck, if an inmate at Angola told me don't go there, it's dangerous, I was not about to go there.
Right.
But, you know, it's amazing how when they realized I was there to help them not die alone, which is one of the biggest fears they have going into prison. That's one of the things that my research told me, is it's not about getting shanked or raped. Or, I mean, that is a fear. But over 85% of the people I talked to said their greatest fear going into prison was dying alone, dying in prison.
Wow.
That's a horrible thing. I mean, you ask people outside of prison, and they'll tell you they're afraid to die alone.
Sure, sure.
That's not something most people aim to do. You know, we think of death as being surrounded by our loved ones or things that we care about. We don't think about it being, you know, in 4 walls with, you know, no comfy cushions and no couch and no TV on the wall and no, you know, what it's literally you're in a prison cell with a mattress. And if you are lucky and they have a decent infirmary that you can stay in, you might be in the infirmary, mm-hmm. which is like a not great hospital. And most people don't say they don't want to die in the hospital either. And so all these things that we don't want to do on the outside is really what happens on the inside. And so there is a real concern, and it's founded in not wanting to die alone in prison. I mean, there's a stigma there. There's just the thought of what happens if nobody claims your body in prison as a ward of the state. They will literally put you in a pine box and bury you.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be bury you out in the North 40. There's not necessarily a beautiful cemetery or,
sure.
you know, whatever. Now it's getting better. I will say, since I was at Angola, they have a beautiful death ritual that they have created because one of their wardens, Burl Kane, created it and allowed it to happen.
Hmm.
And what it did to that prison is it changed that prison from one of the most dangerous prisons that I know. My mother, who grew up in the 50s, used to say, "Oh, I've heard of Angola. It feels like I'm sending my 4'10" daughter there. Are you kidding me?" but it's different because they were allowed to be taught to care for each other. They were allowed to be human. And compassion and grace was given to them. And they were allowed to find who they were. And now, in the woodworking shop, one of the things they make is coffins. Some of the most beautiful coffins I've ever seen in my life. And I believe Billy Graham was buried in an Angola coffin.
Really?
I think so. I kind of remember when he passed hearing that because he, you know, he had been there and he mm-hmm. saw it. And, I mean, they make beautiful, they have a horse-drawn carriage that pulls the coffin or carries the coffin, drawn by two Persian horses, giant, you know, beautiful horses, a black one and a white one because of the unity. It's pulled by an inmate named Mr. Bones, and that is his real name. I was like, no, he just goes by Bones. And they were like, no, that's his real name. And he drives that, and the prison family, whoever they are, the people that they got close to, walk behind the casket. And, you know, people go, wow, you're walking behind a casket. That's you know, a big deal. It's an even bigger deal when you consider they are in Louisiana. Their prison uniform is not shorts. It's jeans and usually long sleeve shirts of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And they will walk over 2 miles with that casket to where they bury their
Wow.
That is commitment.
So who? What was the name of the warden again?
Burl Kane, C-A-I-N, and he wrote, or somebody wrote, I can't remember if he wrote it, a book called Kane's Redemption,
mm-hmm.
and it is all about what Warden Kane did. And, you know, he started a rodeo. It's funny you mentioned the football game at Vacaville. He started a rodeo, and it's still going on, you know, now, and he retired, I want to say recently, but maybe 10 years, 5, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't like it was, you know, in the 1800s or a long, long time ago. You know, he just recently retired. He was the warden when I did my work there. And he made a difference. And, you know, what that tells me is it takes one person.
Mm-hmm.
One person with the right heart in the right place that can do the right thing. And that's honestly what spurred me on to do what I do, and that's, you know, to advocate, to talk to people, to get people to consider who they are compassionate about, because we all like to say we're compassionate, right? I don't think if you ask any of your listeners, are you all, who's not compassionate? I don't think you'd get many hands raised. You know, people are compassionate and like to think they're compassionate, but my question is always, but there's always an asterisk, right? The little star that goes behind the word, the asterisk. Because who are you compassionate to? We tend to be compassionate to the people who we love,
mm-hmm.
who make us look good, who we know, who, you know, what. But what about the people who, for all intents and purposes, who Christ loved, right?
Right.
What about the tax collectors? What about the dirty people? What about the homeless people? What about the people who smell funny? What about the people who are beggars? What about the people in prison? I want to say that many of us have compassion for those people, but where does your compassion end? And I always challenge people, who are you compassionate to? And it's okay to say, I'm not compassionate to those people. I mean, that's all right. You know yourself, and there's nothing wrong with that. But before we raise the compassion flag and pat ourselves on the back, let's think about who are those people that we might pretend we don't see, or we don't like to talk about, or we don't want to go to prison ministry because we don't like the prisons, or we don't want to go to a nursing home because they smell funny, or we don't want to, you know, whatever. We can make up a million reasons, but all of us have that asterisk. And so, you know, who is it? And then how do you overcome that asterisk? How do you take that footnote out of your life?
Corey, we are against the clock here. we would love to get you back on.
Absolutely.
And maybe
I can obviously talk about this.
maybe talk specifically about prisons in California as well.
Yes,
and if you're willing to come back on, we would love to talk to you again. It's you're doing the Lord's work.
Well, I'm doing it because He did it in me first.
Yeah. Yep.
He did it for me first. So now it's what can I do to give back?
So well said. Thanks so much for joining us. We will be in touch, and thanks for all you do to make this a better world.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Corey. God bless. That's Corey Novak, who is Dr. Corey Novak. And just, you know, prison ministry, I've spent, I haven't been a prisoner, but I have spent time in prisons, and not as prison ministry, but as part of my education, and those are real human beings, and they're all made in the image and likeness of God, and so good for the people that are able to show compassion to them. And I didn't know that they had hospice as well, and that's good to know as well, and that's pretty compelling stories. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless everyone.
To the cross I look, and to the cross I cling. Of its suffering I do drink, of its work I do sing. On it my Savior, both bruised and crushed, showing that God is love, God is just. At the cross you beckon me, you draw me gently to my knees, and I am lost for words, so lost in love, how sweetly broken, wholly surrendered. Deserved life have I been given through Christ crucified. You've called me out of death, you called me into life, and I was under your wrath. Through the cross I'm reconciled. Let's go.
beckoning. You draw me gently to my knees, and I am lost for words, so lost in love.